Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 62, section 7, which is on old single column, page 709. All right, so recall that we are in the midst of the long-awaited-for event. A trillion years of universe evolution in the making, immediately 550 million years of biologic evolution on this planet in the making. We have the first two will creatures. We have those exceptional twins that suddenly sprung out of the primates, the so-called primates, those highest mammals that we've ever had, and we got, to the point where they had stepped us through in section six. They had stepped us through that reminder that over the course of those 550 million years, now specifically 450 million with the animals evolving, so that from the point when you had the first adjutant engaging, they were reminding us of over those hundreds of millions of years, you had just the first adjutant, and then you had the first and the second, then you had the first, second, and third, and it's been building up, and you're bringing two thoughts together as you're going to have for the first time the sixth and seventh adjutants engaging the only two creatures that they can engage, right? These twins, and reminding you that those twins started as single-celled creatures, right, as they were conceived in their, in their mother's womb, and first, that single-celled animal, just the first adjutant was engaged, and then at some point the second and the third, et cetera, and they got us to the point of, if you look, back the last two paragraphs there of section six. When they were about 10, you had the sixth adjutant engaging them. And then when they were about 11, the seventh. Now, of course, for us now, a reminder of, two things. One, these are the first two creatures that are crossing that threshold to get to sixth and the seventh. So it's not surprising there might be a little delay in that, from our perspective. But also we are, we have the benefit of a lot more evolution than they. And so now, it's roughly at age six that the seventh adjutant engages us. It wasn't until about 11 for them. So that's almost been cut in half. Over the last million years of human evolution. But nonetheless, you finally had all seven of those adjutants engaging an individual. And we go forth from there. And just to get us in fully into mode here of starting up the seventh section, I'm going to reread that final little paragraph there of section six, because the section seven, is immediately referring to it, so we can remind ourselves what it is that they're talking about in their first sentence of section seven. So they said there was an immediate and new order of mobilization of the seven adjutant mind spirits. We, remember the life carriers, and one of the life carriers is writing these papers, we were alive with expectation. We realized that the long-awaited for hour was approaching. We knew we were upon the threshold of the realization of our protracted effort to evolve will creatures on Urantia. And remind you again of... I was explaining that bit about that new order of mobilization. Remember, the adjutants have shifted into the second phase here now of their mobilization. As long as you have Anna Infanta and their children, you know, and their descendants going forward, the adjutants are not in the mode where they are fostering any pre-will creatures up to the will level. So that's been turned off, and they've shifted into this new mode where now they're very focused on advancing the human qualities in the now existent will creatures. I mean, there's going to be some engagement of the animal stock. Right? There's going to, it's not going to totally shut down, but there's definitely a lot of focus. I mean, whatever happens with animal stocks is now very much with the existence of will creatures in mind and supporting their mindedness. Okay. So the fact that there is this, complete change in how the Creative Mother Spirit, how the Divine Minister is ministering adjutant mind to this specific world. And it's not any other world, but it's just, she focalizes that adjutant ministry in a specific way to each inhabited world or each, not until there's will creatures, it isn't technically an inhabited world, but to each world where there's life, right, has a specific focus. And so she is adjusting that, just this focalization onto this world, that it's obviously a phenomenon that is known throughout the local universe of Nebadon. Okay? This is, everyone knows that this event has occurred. You can actually observe the change, at the local universe headquarters. So there is going to be an immediate acknowledgement of this success on the part of these life carriers that have been here for so long working on this. And so, see, that's the significance of the title here of Section 7. So let's just get into it here.
Number 7. Recognition as an inhabited world. We did not have to wait long. At noon, the day after the runaway of the twins, there occurred the initial test flash of the universe circuit signals at the planetary reception focus of Urantia. We were, of course, all astir with the realization that a great event was impending. But since this world was a life experiment station, we had not the slightest idea of just how we would be apprised of the recognition of intelligent life on the planet. But we were not long in suspense. On the third day after the elopement of the twins and before the life carrier corps departed, there arrived the Nebadon Archangel of initial planetary circuit establishment.
Okay, so you can see the big issue that's in play, and they'll explain it a little bit more here as we continue on. So I don't want to fully flesh it out right now, but the planet has been connected into the whole communication grid. And so, obviously, I mean, there's, you know, other beings are coming into play here. I mean, that doesn't just happen magically, right? That there's all kinds of technicalities to that, getting us connected into the whole communication grid. So things are definitely astir. And, you know, you can think about how, you know, the logistics of all these doings, including all the stuff that they aren't even alluding to. There's going to be all kinds of things that are going to be going on that have to get set up. They would have been anticipating all of this for quite a while because there's travel times, you know, and whatnot. I mean, so you know, everyone on high has been watching this. You know, it's not just the life carriers that are immediately present to you know, as they're seeing it go from dawn mammals to mid mammals to the primates. I mean, everyone is noticing, you know, sees that it's, you know, about to happen. And so everyone has been working all over the local universe to get everything all set up. And so when an event happens in very short order, boom, they hit the ground running. I mean, you know, on the third day after, right, they've got an archangel arriving. Okay? I mean, you know, he can't, you know, travel at three times the speed of light, you know, and seraphim, you know, from very far away and get here in 3 days, okay? I mean, so he was en route, you know, long before, but look at the timing, right? I mean, time to arrive, you know, in a very appropriate time, right after the event. So just reminds you how much what's going on this planet is known, like we've been stressing. If they want to look up, you know, exactly on the dial, you know, on the meters, what quantity and quality of, you know, to however many decimal places you're using the fourth adjutant right now, you know, they can look that up at the local universe headquarters. I mean, so, you know, our minds are an open book. Right? I mean, countless beings, you know everything that's going on in all kinds of different ways.
Archangel has to travel by seraphim.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, they can't, you know, self translate themselves, right? So
that was the initial test flash.
Yeah.
I mean, like that kind of.
And so, just, yeah, see, that reminds you of the physics of it. I mean, you know, they connect it up and you got to test it. It's like, well, is it working? You know, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Right. I mean, they literally have to send a test signal through, make sure that everything is connected up properly. There's a whole elaborate physics to all this stuff. And so, you know, they've got all their tests, everything is up and rolling. Coincidentally, you know, very promptly before the archangel arrives. And then there's also the interesting thing of, you know, they don't really explain, but there must be a lot of variability from experimental world to experimental world, exactly how this works. I suppose one of the things that was very much a question mark for them is, you know, the fact that they set it up so that you had these pre-sangic will creatures. You know, they didn't quite know what the whole protocol for handling that was going to be. You know, you do see that you've got those, you know, the archangels are taking a lead role because, you know, they focus very much on, you know, not just on survival issues, you know, resurrection, you know, whatnot issues, but on the ascension part of what's going on. You know, they're not directly involved, you may recall, in all of the, you know, basic local universe administration sort of stuff. You know, in general, they're not working under Gabriel like that. You know, and so, you know, you have the first potential ascenders, you know, on this world. And so you're seeing that acknowledgement that, you know, who arrived is an archangel.
Nebadon.
So right.
You had to travel a lot further than just the
answer. Well, yeah, well, see, I mean, you know, this is, you know, you don't, I mean, you know, they're stressing that it's not, you know, it's not like an archangel from a different local universe, right? I mean, it's one of ours. But yeah, I mean, you don't know if right. If it was one that was stationed on, you know, on Gerasim or whatnot. But anyway, you've got, You've got that interesting fact that, you know, we all immediately are thinking, huh, well, that's kind of interesting. So they didn't know exactly who arrived, and it's an archangel. And coincidentally, Michael set up these special things where we have a divisional headquarters of the archangels, and we have this archangel circuit on the planet now. And you can't help but notice that there's some kind of a curiosity there. It's not like at this point when they sent this archangel that anyone knew that this was going to be a rebellion and a default world and Michael's bestowal world and yada, 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 right? So that's kind of an interesting little bit of supremacy, you know, that appears to actually be supremacy, just the way they word that, that we had not the slightest idea of just, right? So don't know what that means, but it's an interesting little point to note. And let's see, anything else immediately there? We'll talk a little bit more here in a second about, you know, when they talk about this planetary reception focus. Let me pick that up here. Let me read a little bit more.
It was an eventful day on Urantia when our small group gathered about the planetary pole of space communication and received the first message from Salvington over the newly established mind circuit of the planet. And this first message, dictated by the chief of the Archangel Corps, said...
Yeah, before you read that, let's just deal with the technicalities there, and then we'll get to the actual message. You know, depending upon what they want to emphasize, you know, they refer to this... this pole, you know, in different ways, in different places in the book. Maybe the focus is more on the spiritual, and so you might, you know, speak about, you know, that pole being the designated, you know, spiritual headquarters on the planet. Another place you might refer to it as the energy pole if you're really kind of focusing on the immediate physics of it. But the point is, you know, we're long before we have a prince and his staff. You know, we don't have an actual planetary headquarters set up. But, you know, from this point forward, there's always going to be some location that is established by the power beings as this anchor point for where, you know, if you will, the planet is plugged in to the communication grid. Okay, and, you know, like we've talked about with this communication grid, that, you know, first of all, you have the energy controller beings that are laying a line of energy that's connected into the grid from the planet, and then you have those spirit controller beings that they just, you know, allude to a couple times in the book that are laying a parallel line of spirit energy, right? And so then you have a super additive consequence of mind energy, you know, between those, the two plates, if you will, right? The walls of this conductor for this line of communication. And see, they're literally referring to that mind energy. See, the newly established mind circuit of the planet. They don't mean, you know, like some adjutant or barancha mind or something like that. This is not mind that's being ministered to creatures. This is the literal mind energy, you know, that these communications go through between the spirit energy and physical energy. Boundaries for this conduit. Okay? So you've got this mind conduit, then.
Two plates.
Well, it's just you have, you know, just think of it in as two parallel plates, sort of. You know, one is a physical energy line, and the other is a spirit energy line. And if they want to shut it down, remember what they tell you. They just the beings that control the spirit energy side of it, they take that away. So then the mind energy conduit that the communications go through disappears because you don't have a super additive consequence anymore.
And you're in quarantine.
right? And you're, you know, that planet's quarantined or whatever is being quarantined, yeah. So the physical energy line stays, you know, in a like a quarantine situation, some sort of shutdown situation. They just take away that spirit line. And it's literally, I mean, you want to think of it as sort of as mind energy that is stemming from that spirit energy line of energy that they lay out. And you can see that as, you know, I pulled the spirit energy endpoint, right, away, and the mind energy disappears. Right? So it's not like with us, where, you know, we really think of our mind energy as stemming up from our matter. And then you can stick a spirit cap on top of that. You know, here it's much more mind energy that you've visualized, you know, as an extension from the spirit energy towards the material energy line of, you know, that's laid out. Okay?
We are not quarantined?
We're quarantined, yes.
Quarantined.
Yeah.
Now we are.
Yeah. But back then, see, you know, long time before the rebellion here.
It's not the same thing as the mind of the mother spirit necessarily, which was here anyway, or everywhere present.
Right. Yeah. See, you know, here we're talking about literal. Yeah. I mean, you know, you lay out the two substances, if you will, right? The physical energy and the spirit energy, and then the mind energy, you know, pours out between the two plates. you know, it's just innately the super additive consequence of bringing those two in relationship. See, and so that gives you a little thought about, it's like, huh, well now, so when they make Morantia substance and they weave physical and spiritual energy together, they must do it in some way where you don't get mind energy, you know, innately generated by it. You know, that has, you know, for that you have to have mind to come, or Morantia mind down and attuned to it. You know, so there's obviously ways that they can bring spirit energy and physical energy together and have this super additive consequence in ways that you can't. I mean, the first thing that just strikes you is, you know, you picture in the one case it's parallel, and in the other case you're picturing it as being, you know, at right angles to each other, woven together like a warp and a woof, you know, and maybe that short circuits, you know, the super additive consequence or something. I mean, I don't know what the physics is.
So let's stay on this for 2 seconds. Because like today, if we're still in quarantine, then we don't necessarily have that mind energy circuit that they're describing here.
Right. Well, and we have the archangels have their circuit that's just like this.
Right, but yeah, so but that mind energy circuit they're talking, what does it do? In other words,
literally, I mean, for us, I mean, you know, it's just like the copper wire in a, you know, in a phone line. I mean, it's just instead of conducting the signal through copper, you're conducting it through mind energy. It's just it's just a conductor.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
And
you're using mind energy as an energy.
It's not there now, but we're not. So that's why we're not. I gotcha.
Yeah. See, and it, you know,
communication.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you're using it, you know, as just literally as an energy, and modulating it in some way. That's not the thing that you recognize. It's like, wow, I mean, imagine how complete a communication you could send through a mind energy conduit compared through a copper wire, right? Right?
All the stuff from, you know, from...
Right? Because it's literally, you know,
universe messages come.
Right now, I've got all my thoughts and stuff, you know, are associated with mind energy. I mean, see, so you can imagine I could just plug in, right, and send that through a mind energy, quote unquote, wire.
Can you say bandwidth?
Right, it's going to be very high bandwidth, right? And
so when you're
not subject to the you know, resistance and whatnot, issues with physical energy. And
Something's interfering with the communication.
You were differentiating between like that spirit, it's like top down to get the mind. And then it's super additive, too, on the physical energy. But you were talking about the Marantxa warp and woof spirit and
physical matter. Energy. Yeah.
And so and then Marantxa mind seated on that.
Yeah.
So but it had to be different. It's going to be different. So maybe that isn't top down. Maybe that's
Well, yeah. See, again, like it's like with like adjutant mind. Remember, they call them the adjutant mind spirits. Right? I mean, why do they call them mind spirits? Because, I mean, there is, it is reaching down from spirit towards matter in terms of how it is, ministered to us by the creative mother spirit, right? Stemming down, reaching down from her spirit presence. Is her mind presence reaching down to us? But I was just saying, from our perspective, right? I mean, we don't see it that way, right? From our perspective, we just have this blob of matter, right? With mind extending up from it, and eventually, when the seventh adjutant, connects up, then in comes spirit, a spirit cap on our, vertical energy nature. But actually, of course, right, the spirit was already there. Right? It's just, again, that spirit presence was not focalized down to you in an individual way. It was ubiquitously present, and not accessible to you. I mean, again, we can't do any of this ourselves. It's not like we can reach up and pull the Holy Spirit down and get, and now have it. Right? I mean, we're just, helpless victims of antecedent causation, in this regard. I mean, we have to wait for the Creative Mother Spirit to bring everything down to us. She brings the first adjutant down to us as a single-celled conception, and she brings the second adjutant, et cetera, until finally she brings the Holy Spirit down. And, they try to adjust the way they talk about it a little bit to appreciate what a big deal it is to have the Holy Spirit engaged to you, rather than saying that an adjutant is encircuited in you, they say that you are encircuited in the Holy Spirit. See, they've reciprocated to just remind you of how what has up to this point been very much an isolated individual phenomenon in many ways. Now has direct contact with the whole. It's the Holy Spirit. Yeah. And again, remember, when I stress it like that, I'm not just playing on the words. H-O-L-Y literally is a word etymologically derived from W-H-O-L-L-Y. Right? I mean, it is the same word etymologically. It's just it's taken on this other meaning, indicating, more sacred. But the revelators are trying to remind you all the time of, remember what it means literally, and that's, you have more of the truth of it. Don't go all, magical, sacred-y about it, right? It is the W-H-O-L-L-Y spirit, right? It is your initial relationship to the whole, right? The part becomes encircuited in the whole. Okay.
Imagine the guy thought all this up. So this circuit is like the internet connection for each world to the cosmos.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're just, now this world has an IP address, right? Yeah.
Interstellar provider.
We don't know where in the heck this, way that we don't understand, some point was selected, back here a million years ago to be this designated, special point, right, geographically on the planet. once you had, you know, 500,000 years ago, once you had the prince's staff, okay, it would have been there, right, at the prince's headquarters. And then once that gone away, you know, then, you know, again, you're wondering all the way to today, well, exactly where is this? And have they changed it a number of times? What's involved in changing it? You can imagine it must be like all kinds of logistics to that. But anyway, we're plugged in. And so now, you know, you've got this, you know, they said they had this archangel of initial planetary circuit establishment. You can see that the archangels are playing a lot of role just in this circuit setup stuff. So again, it's not surprising that they have their own, you know, grid, communication grid, that does have an active node here right now. But it's also apparent from that prior paragraph that, you know, he didn't come just for the sake of the communication grid, because the life carriers are obviously indicating that he, in a way, is sort of like the official, right? That's present. You don't have a planetary prince or anything else, so he's kind of the official celestial being that has come to, you know, to be present here. And we, I'll mention a little bit. We don't technically get to it until we get a couple more papers. Until we get the Over Control of Evolution paper, but you might recall you do eventually have some officials here prior to the planetary prince, besides the life carriers. You've got 12 what are called Melchizedek observers that set up residence here, and so, you know, you wonder, it's like, well, did they just set up their headquarters where this pole was set up, or did they decide they wanted a headquarters somewhere else and they had to move the pole? I don't know. Okay, anyway, let's see what the chief of the archangels, right, is going to send a message from Salvington.
To the life carriers on Urantia, greetings. We transmit assurance of great pleasure on Salvington, Edentia, and Gerasim, in honor of the registration on the headquarters of Nebadon of the signal of the existence on Urantia of mind of will dignity. The purposeful decision of the twins to flee northward and segregate their offspring from their inferior ancestors has been noted. This is the first decision of mind, the human type of mind, on Urantia, and automatically establishes the circuit of communication over which this initial message of acknowledgement is transmitting.
Right, so the beings that are involved in the circuit, they're waiting for that moment, and they punch the start button or whatever, you know, they have to do to initiate it. Okay, there's several little tidbits in there. Besides just the fascinating fact that you've got this being, you know, sending this message from Salvington. Yep.
What are they referring to when they say automatically establishes?
Yeah, just that, like I was saying, that the beings that are in charge of all the physics of the communication linkage, right? You know, they you know, plug it in, you know, put the final brick in the system, right? The moment that there's this, you know, that will is functioning, you know, so it's, you know, it's just, you know, they're not waiting for orders, and they just automatically set it up. You know, so it's, you know, it's just part of the routine, that the moment that you have creatures of will dignity, the planet gets plugged in like this. They're on it, right? That's what I mean. You know, so like I said, everyone has been watching this in all kinds of different ways, and right, they're all, right, everyone knows their job, you know. And
is there no delay with this message? It comes becomes instantaneously?
This we don't know exactly, you know, all these issues.
It
of,
seems like it's kind of...
We don't know exactly how the travel times for these signals are.
Do we know anything about routing? Like, is it a network that is... Does it have to travel to Nebanon and then to another world if you're trying to communicate, you know?
I mean, there's just all kinds of things. We just really don't know exactly how this works.
There was one message that got stuck in the
middle. obviously, you know, they've not laid an independent line between here and Salvington, right? I mean, it's some short little, you know, line that plugs into a node somewhere. I mean, I don't know where, I mean... Is all, you know, they never explain, you know, but you kind of get the impression that it's that there's a complexity to it that isn't just tied to like architectural worlds stuff. I mean, I think it stands on its own in a way that they don't fully explain.
They're wetting your ass.
Because there are a couple of things they say about that are a little mysterious. So the points that I wanted to just note here in passing. First of all, you notice that on Salvington, you know, they didn't have to have words sent to them. They've got all the details already. Right? They don't just know that there's mind of will dignity. They know the specifics of what the twins are thinking and doing.
Yeah.
Right? You are an open book. Right? If they want to know what you're doing, they know everything you're thinking, everything they're doing. Right? There is no hiding, okay? We've talked about this many times.
Why do you need the mind circuit then?
Then there's all those questions too. See when do you use the circuit? When do you use reflectivity? When do you use beings that kind of have different sorts of linkages? Yeah, I mean, they don't explain all this. I it's come up a few times as we've touched upon these things. There's lots of questions about this. I totally don't know. You can say that beings that are here that don't have some sort of extraordinary abilities, if they're going to communicate off-world, they obviously are going to need this communication line. But there are a lot of other beings that just know stuff. Okay, so remember when we were talking, that's all the Sakanafim and all these, there's all kinds of beings that know lots of things. And then so there's that, just amazingly that they've noted, these details about their decisions. So you notice they're speaking of decisions, they're talking about literal decision forms in those mindal selves, right? So they're examining, right, your thoughts directly, right, as forms in mind energy. And
you think the life carrier
only knew about those details of those thoughts from the message?
No, the life carriers are also, tracking all this stuff too, yeah.
So the Nebanon archangel might be a different archangel than one of the chief of archangels. Because there were two different archangels.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, you got the archangel that's here on this end, and the chief, is back on Salvington, yeah.
String with the can at each end.
I wanted to focus on, when they use that expression, mind of will dignity, right? Remember to think precisely about that wherever you see it. Merely having all seven adjutants doesn't give you a mind of will dignity. Right? Instantaneously subsequent to that, you have the encircuitment in the Holy Spirit, and then the possibility for a personality to identify, right, because personality is spirit pattern. So until there's literal relationship to spirit energy for that individual, personality can't engage. And if there's not personality, you don't have will. Right, so, when they talk about mind of will dignity, they're reminding you of super adjutant facts, the encirclement in the Holy Spirit and the identification of a personality. And again, Anna Infanta's personalities have existed infinitely ubiquitously present since before time began. Right? But at this moment, when they were 11, boom, they focalized down and identified with either Andon or Fanta. There's a mystery of mysteries to all that, of going from infinity and eternity to a specific point in time and space. So the bestowal, is not... It's not like he's throwing something out from paradise, and it slaps onto the side of the head of Andon, right? I mean, he's not bestowing it like that, right? It's ubiquitously, infinitely present, to begin with. Yeah.
All I can do is ponder it, because I can't really see how they know a true decision from just a run-of-the-mill decision. Because how many times do we... advanced humans, decide to do something and nothing ever comes of it because the next 10 minutes later we forget our decision. <something different>.
Yeah, I mean...
I bet they can easily see it.
I mean, they know all the details, of how minds work and how and everything. They can, to the degree to which you don't have personality involved in altering the causal sequence in mind energy, right? They can predict at 90 decimal places everything you do and think, right? Including, you interacting with countless other beings and things, and they can, calculate all that stuff.
It's probably like a little flash type thing that they can just see it. Quickly.
Yeah, and then the other thing to point out there is, in general, there's no one needs to be, looking into my consciousness and he just got an inkling for a burrito. No one in the universe cares, right? I mean, they're not watching you that closely. But if they wanted to, they could, focus in on me. And write down, at such and such a time, at such and such location, Chris thought of bean burritos. They could know that if they wanted to.
That is probably more sophisticated than writing it down, I'm sure.
Yeah. and here, obviously, the whole local universe's attention is focused on, this incredible event. This is a huge event.
They said Jesus would know what people were thinking. Right, they have access to being able to do that.
Yeah. So there's the will dignity thing, to make sure you appreciate that technical term that they often throw out, and then all the specificity of what they know. And then we already talked about that whole bit about how it automatically establishes this. So you've got you've got all this, and again, you see the registration. I remember there's all of this, what we would think of as bureaucratic stuff. Everything is all duly recorded and whatnot. We've seen that from the very beginning, way back there, 900 million years ago. They were recording things and whatnot. So, all right. So. Beyond all the technical stuff we've been talking about there, notice what they highlight to segregate their offspring from their inferior ancestors. See, they're noting reflective thinking. Right, that the twins are stepping back and reflecting on the situation and going, oh, there's a difference there. They're discriminating between human quality and subhuman quality, right? And acting upon that. Let's see. So just
a lot of people don't do that today.
Yeah, right. It's sad to record that people
we're
not
recording anymore.
Are not as discriminating when they choose a mate. Yes. So it's just interesting of all the things they could have, you know, focused on. You know that that it's a thought that today, you couldn't even say this in many circles because you know it's politically incorrect. You can't call someone inferior.
No.
Right? That's a word that you're not allowed to use. You're discriminating. Yes, that's what humans do. They discriminate. That's what the three cosmic intuitions allow you to do. Right? See, so they're noting the insights. You know, it's that will dignity, the exercise of insight to, as a predicate for their decision there. That's right. I was going to note one other little thing there. When they say the first decision of mind, and then they parenthetically say the human type of mind, that's like when Jesus, in the Jesus papers, they give you the names for the levels of meaning. You got the level of the flesh, the first level of meaning, the level of the feelings, second level of meaning, and then the third level is called the level of mind. And you're going, well, I mean, aren't I minded? down there on the first and second levels, there's the levels of meaning after all. Doesn't that imply minded? Yes, but see, it's in the same mode. Yeah, you're technically minded, but you haven't reached the human type of mind until you get up to the third level of meaning. That's the level of mind that's worth talking about. And what does Jesus say? Well, I find you, on the first or second levels of meaning. In other words, I find you a fancy animal, and I would lead you up, right? To recognition, step one, right? To actually make conscious use of human mind. Right? That's a cutting statement. He's saying, most of you, yeah, technically you're humans, but none of you are availing yourselves of any human quality of mind. Except superconsciously, right? I mean, consciously, you're just doing fancy animal stuff, right? And it's not really technically considered minded. I mean, it's definitely not a mind activity that anyone in the universe is going to take any time to look into and be curious about what's happening there, right? It's just yada, 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 right? They're not going to take note of every time a dog gets excited about a stick or something, right? And just because your fancy stick stuff is fancy, it's not as, any more interesting to anyone on high. Okay. See, they're just stressing that again. Now there's mind worth talking about. And it's sad to record that so few persons on Urantia have mind that's worth talking about. Right? That's paper 16, section 6. That anyone would take any time to actually look up and see what's going on with it. Okay. All right, so a lot in that one little paragraph there. If it is worth quote unquote tweeting about, remember they do, right? I mean, if there's something interesting there, they actually pump it out into the whole grid. And give everyone in the universe access to that. If there's something that your absolutely unique creativity did with that mind, right? No one cares about what it does just automatically, causally as a mind energy. But if you did something creative, artificial, unnatural, right, and it's noteworthy, They tell everyone in the universe of universes that. Go, everyone, take a look at this. Consider this. This is a a clever new addition to the total.
Welcome to Spacebook.
All right. So it goes out. But that doesn't happen much off of this planet. You know, it's sad to record that Sophia. Right. Okay.
Next, over this new circuit came the greetings of the Most Highs of Edentia, containing instructions for the resident life carriers, forbidding us to interfere with the pattern of life we had established. We were directed not to intervene in the affairs of human progress. It should not be inferred that life carriers ever arbitrarily and mechanically interfere with the natural outworking of the planetary evolutionary plans, for we do not. But up to this time, we had been permitted to manipulate the environment and shield the life plasm in a special manner. And it was this extraordinary but wholly natural supervision that was to be discontinued.
Okay, let's treat the latter part of that first.
That one was extraordinary.
Right, so, you know, recall when they say ever arbitrarily or mechanically and mechanically interfere. Okay. Remember that there, we'll get to this again when we get to the Over Control of Evolution paper, but there, when they are, you know, for a brief period of time, when they're actually constructing those first eukaryotic plant cells that they're going to, you know, deposit in those three locations, the life carriers are in a, they've been transformed into a body and energy state where they can literally, you know, horizontally interact with, you know, the electrochemical systems that they're working on. They can get literally hands-on with this stuff, you know, mechanically, like they're saying there, okay? But as soon as they've got it all in place, you know, as soon as both phases of life animation have come from, you know, in the second phase, from the creative mother spirit, right, through them and engage that eukaryotic cell, then they're immediately put back in the mode where they aren't hands-on anymore. Okay? And so they've been in that close but not directly hands-on mode this whole time they're referring to. But even though they can't literally, you know, get down in the mud and muck with it, right? You know, they've been doing indirect things, and we've been talking about that. And, you know, they kind of hint at it a little bit. You know, you can imagine that the power beings, remember, it's just the life carriers and the power beings that have been here. You know, it certainly sounds like the power beings are helping out in various ways here. See, manipulating the environment, shielding the life plasm. I mean, see, those, I mean, the master physical controllers must be, you know, doing some things. But now that there's mind of will dignity, you know, it has to be even more hands off, and in general, they're so hands off they're literally taken off the planet. Okay, but some can stay, and remember that as we read back in paper 36, there is a group that stays. They're going to mention that again here in just a second here. And this life carrier that's writing these papers is one of those that stayed. Okay, so that's what they're talking about there. Now, the other part is interesting to note. You know, remind yourself of the difference of beings on high. So the archangel, you know, starts out, greetings, exclamation point, right? You know, and like I said, I mean, the archangels are all, they're all interested in, you know, the ascension, you know, of will creatures and all this. And okay, and then the deputies of the capital J judges, right, the Most Highs, come in and say, you know, containing instructions forbidding us, right? All right. The law gets laid down. So it's just the contrast is very striking. Between the local boss guys, the Most Highs, and everyone says, yes, sir. So that just really, stands out in contrast here. Like I said, they'll pick up the rest of that here in a minute about them taking these, an oath not to monkey around if they're going to stay on the planet and that stuff.
What do you think they mean by shield the life plasma?
You're just left to wonder.
If lightning was going to strike.
I mean, what are we shielding from? I mean, it could range everything from sub-electronic issues to literal rocks falling off of cliffs. I mean, I have, who knows what it means. Your speculation can just run with it.
You spotted that frog, you jumped, Justin.
You're supposed to know the answer way later on, though.
It basically just, they give you enough to say, and you can speculate on that. You can begin to think about that. Just what would be appropriate and what would not, not be. And, we'll see as we get into the story of Anna Infanta, if you don't remember, that it's not like they're micromanaging us, and I've got to make sure that Gene doesn't stub his toe today. I mean, it doesn't work like that. I think everyone should appreciate that. third individual, level of beings chime in, and this is interesting. I hinted at this that we were going to read something that forces us to reconsider something we considered long ago here. So, yeah.
And no sooner had the Most Highs left off speaking than the beautiful message of Lucifer, then sovereign of the Satania system, began to planetize. Now the life carriers heard the welcome words of their own chief and received his permission to return to Gerasim. This message from Lucifer contained the official acceptance of the life carrier's work on Urantia and absolved us from all future criticism of any of our efforts to improve the life patterns of Nebadon as established in the Satania system.
Okay, so before we get to the that final part, it's like, seriously, absolved them from all future criticism? So everyone who's been racking up all these criticisms, like, okay, I'm going to have a long talk with them about mosquitoes and and things like this, right? It's like, seriously.
I think it's typical of Lucifer to think in terms of criticism and being absolved, or is that just...
No, and again, this is way back when Lucifer is.
But he still had those seeds.
There was no actualization of any sort of a seed, even in the smallest degree.
I don't trust him ever.
Yeah, well.
It seems like that would be just the kind of thing that he'd say.
If anything, he's very intrigued by what a fantastic job they did, in pushing the envelope on creativity and what can be done, with the raw material that the powers that be have granted to us all.
Yeah, for all he was in on the plan. Have a look at that creating will early. As well.
Yeah.
But when you see the beautiful message,
Right. See, again, you want to remember, there's a reason why they took the our name Lucifer and applied it to him, because he's extremely brilliant. And you can tell of all the beings, you know, including the chief of the archangels, I mean, the life carriers are most just, you know, delighted, you know, by, I mean, because it's, you know, it's the next best thing to being there. They're getting through this mind energy conduit. You know, his incredible brilliance, you know, sweeps them up even remotely. You know, you can tell that they just, it's just to hear his voice again, you know, brings peace again to the universe. You know, I mean, he was very brilliant. I mean, Lanonadex are in general, you know, impressive that way to the lower orders of beings. And he was exceptionally so. He was a brilliantly illuminated mind, right? And like I said, that's why it's appropriate for them to use the name Lucifer. He is the bearer of illuminated mind. Okay, so there's all of that. But this should, if you have any memory of details, you should go, wait a minute. This is a million years ago. What? Lucifer? So you go back to paper 53, section 2, on page 602 in the single column, you know, just because he was like, well, maybe I'm not remembering this correctly. And you go and say, oh, and you read, it says, Lucifer and his first assistant, Satan, had reigned on Gerizim for more than 500,000 years when in their hearts they began to array themselves against the Universal Father and his then vicegerent son, Michael. So remember, you know, remember back when we did, you know, this paper, we were looking at that and we're going, okay, so more than 500,000 years, okay, he had reigned. And remember that, you know, they said in the section just before that, that Satan had never served. You remember this conversation? We were noticing that they said that Satan never served, and we were reminding ourselves of, oh yeah, and they told us back with the Lanonadex, you know, in this section about the Lanonadex, that you have this, you know, group of two or three that are commissioned to a world, and every 10,000 standard years, so in other words, 50,000 Urantia years, every 10,000 standard years, the Most Highs either reinstate the Lanonadic that was a system sovereign, again as system sovereign, or swap it with one of the other, you know, one or two that are with him. But in this case, we thought, oh, and they told you that it never had, the Most Highs, see, it never had any issue at all with Lucifer. He's just spot on fantastic, right? And so they just, they didn't change it up. They reinstated him, and we were noticing, it's like, wow. So they reinstated him over and over and over again. When we were getting specific, we thought, well, okay, so it says he reigned on Gerizim for more than 500,000 years. Okay, so they must be talking about 500,000 years Gerizim time, system time. You know, it seems like that's the context. I mean, reigned on Gerizim for that amount of time. And they don't say it's standard time or universe time. So your first assumption would be it must be system time. It must be Gerizim time. You know, and that's, remember, the Gerizim year is 81% of a Urantia year. You know, so that would be 405,000 Urantia years. And so we were thinking, okay, so if, you know, it's every 50,000 Urantia years, you know, there's this reassessment and reinstatement. Okay, yeah, so yeah, he'd been reinstated several times.
They switched him out and put him back in.
You know, they say, but they say they don't. I see. So you're going. So everything seemed fine. It all seemed to, you know, it seemed to be the truth was flowing through it. You know, that, remember I pointed out, they stressed that because it's like, you know, how long he had been serving spot on, brilliantly, without any, you know, variation, been reinstated, you know, and, but now we're going, wait a minute. I mean, a million years ago, he was system sovereign. Oh, so that was an incorrect interpretation. That is universe time, you know, standard time. It's 500,000 years universe time, not Gerizim time. Oh, times five. So he had served for 2.5 million years, Urantia time. Whoa. He had been reinstated lots of times. See, it's just even stronger than you thought, right? I mean, he had been assessed, you know, and been given a stamp of you betcha. I mean, we're not even going to swap you with Satan. You are so brilliant, right? You're just going to go on and on all that time. Right?
How unusual that is.
See,
he did say he's one of the top 100.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's, you know, he's one of the very first non-index, and, you know, one of the very, yeah.
Got a low number.
Right, so it really stresses that, okay? See, and that wasn't apparent there. I mean, you know, there's nothing that makes you immediately suspect that that's supposed to be interpreted.
To go, you can't keep somebody the same job if you want.
But,
crazy.
But, you know, in terms of just, you know, besides the specifics of Lucifer, you know, it's a definite reminder that you want to always be on your toes, you know, and be cautious about being too absolutist in your interpretation of something. It may be very, you know, solid, it appears, you know, how you should interpret something, and then, you know, several hundred papers, pages later, all of a sudden you've got another data point, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I got to go back and reassess that. That was not a correct interpretation of that passage. And so actually he was system sovereign before the Ice Age. Remember, the Ice Age was 2.1 million years ago, roughly. And so, you know, he was in place before all the Ice Ages began. You know, the waves of ice began.
So refresh my memory, do they bring in, you know, if they had taken him out, would he still stay in the trio, or do they bring in
Well, in our case it was just two and not three. You know, they say that if for any reason one of the, you know, the initial group that gets assigned, you know, needs to go on to something else, they bring someone in from the reserves to take their place.
So 2.5 million years really doesn't seem like that long a period of time, really.
Well, of course, yeah, from their perspective, it's not very long at all. Yeah, yeah. But it does really amp up the truth flowing through that, you know, that paragraph back there, and just give you a kind of a different factual perspective too, that you know, he was in place before anything on this planet started to really hint at, ooh, I think maybe it's getting really close to humans now, because, right? We understand the Ice Ages are there coincidentally, quote unquote, right, is this little cattle prod to get the humans going. And right. So just to know that he was overseeing what was going on here throughout this whole final phase that we've been reading about, rather than just him coming in the midst of the Ice Age. You know, and you know, having the rebellion, you know, occur, you know, in a much shorter time, relative time after he started. I mean, you know, rebellion wasn't until 200,000 years ago, and he'd been in place since 2.5 million years ago, right? See, so I mean, there was just a very, 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 very long time of stability before he went off the rails. Okay, just kind of, you know, that's an important data point. It really kind of changes your factual assessment of him.
So every 2,000 years, they just kept him in there for all those years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of bringing over.
Yeah.
Is it like 200?
50,000 of our years. Every 50,000 of ours, they do that reassessment.
So for 2 million years.
2.5 million.
2.5 million. Yeah. How many times is that?
Yeah. I mean, it's easier to kind of just keep it in standard time. At 500,000 years, and it's every 10,000 years of standard time that they reassess. See? So, yeah, lots and lots and lots of times. See, so let's see. I think you've got that fascinating term of back to the paragraph here. His beautiful message began to planetize. you gotta love that. Just think, you should be able to reflect on it and understand why they said that. It's, like I said, it's the next best thing to being there. I mean, even though he isn't literally present on the planet face-to-face with the life carriers hearing this, it's almost as if he is. I mean, it's what they get from this communication grid is so realistic, right? It's literally like he's standing there. It's like he's been beamed down to the planet and is speaking. He planetized, Now, literally what the interface looks like and stuff, they don't give us any hints. But you can tell by just them saying that, it's, and for all practical purposes, it's like he's literally standing there. Okay.
What's the name and thing that Magistons had up?
The reflectivity mechanism.
It could be something similar.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as intimate as a reflectivity mechanism. It doesn't give you as, the bandwidth isn't that broad, if you will, right? It isn't that intimate. But it obviously is pretty solid, right? Significantly. It's almost like you can reach up and, wrap your arms around this individual that you're, interacting with via this communication grid. Okay. All right, so let's keep going here.
These messages from Salvington, Edentia, and Jerrison formally marked the termination of the life carrier's age-long supervision of the planet. For ages, we had been on duty, assisted only by the 7 adjutant mind spirits and the master physical controllers. And now, will the power of choosing to worship and to ascend, having appeared in the evolutionary creatures of the planet, we realized that our work was finished and our group prepared to depart. Urantia being a life modification world, permission was granted to leave behind 2 senior life carriers with 12 assistants, and I was chosen as one of this group and have ever since been on Urantia.
It's always fun when they speak in first person like that. And so let's see, I told you they would get back to that. You can't recall, back in paper 36 about the life carriers, when they're talking about life transplantation, they give us some specifics that the core of life carriers commissioned to plant life upon a new world usually consists of 100 senior carriers, 100 assistants, and 1,000 custodians. Okay, so we assume that we had the normal complement. Right, it's going from 1,200 there to just 14. Okay, so most of them are leaving. They actually, at the end of that section, give you the precision. Though 2 of the senior carriers and 12 custodians may volunteer by taking temporary renunciation vows to remain indefinitely on the planet as advisors in the matter of the further development and conservation of the life plasm. 2 such sons and their 12 associates are now serving on Urantia. They're just picking that up again. And just note, there's another example about how you have to stay on your toes when you're, interpreting the book. notice what they say here in what we just read. Two senior life carriers and with 12 assistants. Okay, but they don't mean the technical. Remember, I told you there's three types. There's the seniors, the quote-unquote assistants, and the quote-unquote custodians. And they told you that it's technically the custodian type that are the 12 that say. You know, so here they don't literally mean the assistant type when they say the with 12 assistants. They just mean generically their assistants.
Yeah.
See?
I didn't know what they were in for, did you?
Yeah, they were in for a wild ride. But just again, just notice, you know, in a short span of a few paragraphs here, we've seen a couple examples where, I mean, if you're just a simplistic kind of in the sentence fact finder engaging the book, there's all kinds of opportunities for you to go astray, or at the very least go, oh, I just found, you know, a mistake in the book. And it's like, no, you didn't. Now think, reflect on it. You know, I mean, it doesn't, they don't have to always be in a pedantic mode about it, right? They could just be speaking generally. Now, they're expecting the level of mind kind of individuals to be engaged in this book and not the sad to record fancy animals, right?
Eventually.
The fancy animals, so you can see, are going to have lots of problems. Right? You've got to have that relationship to the whole. You have to keep above the parts, you know, and interpret it truthfully. It doesn't force truth upon you. It gives you, if anything, it gives you lots and lots of opportunity to go off on an erroneous tangent. Just like when Jesus would talk to a crowd. You know, if you wanted to interpret him erroneously, he gave you every opportunity to do it. Because the universe is not interested in those who are not sophistry proof. Right? I mean, it's up to you. Everything is a test. You're exposed, and you have equal opportunity to use your free will creatively or destructively. It's in your hands.
Not everybody has the intelligence. And that doesn't mean they don't spy,
right,
or anything.
Right. Right. See, again, we always get a little bit worried when we talk about this, like, because,
yeah,
right, because we've always thought it's all about my survival. You know, remember, to begin to approach the Urantia book, the first thing you have to have pinned down rock solid is you take your salvation for granted. If you still don't take your salvation for granted, you're dominated by fear.
And, however, a lot of people just getting into this, you know, they haven't got.
That's why they need a proper mentor. And when the blind lead the blind, right?
It's hilarious.
Right? It's just, I'm just trying to stress that. I mean, it's very important that someone has gotten out of the weeds and has an objective relationship to it to help those who are just initially engaging it, because it's filled with potentials for going off the rails. You need to be helped. It's not a beginning text. Okay?
That may be true. However, we've all seen people who have just gotten into it, as we were at that state at one time.
Yeah.
It's done so much to improve their outlook, even without that depth of reflectivity yet.
Yeah, I'm not speaking. Yeah, I'm not speaking to that. I mean, you know, just about anyone can pick it up if they have the courage and can immediately get a lot from it, because they haven't focused in precisely enough to begin with to stumble over things, right? But eventually, they're going to be reading it a second time and a third time, and they're going to start to notice details they didn't notice before. I mean, you know, I remember the first time I read it. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, did I even notice anything? Initially, you know, you have just such a, you know, a high altitude, you know, a relationship to it. But you know, if they stick with it, they're eventually going to come up on something, right?
In 500 years,
trip over. And so there need to be people, in, you know, there, you know, like eventually they might stumble upon, wait a minute, I just found, in a book that one of my favorite quotes from the Urantia book, and it's and Pascal said it. Oh, this is a piece of crap. It's just a forgery. And they throw it away. It's like, no. The book says, see, that person didn't have an appropriate mentor. That, you know, a proper mentor should have, you know, made sure that they recognized, just like it says in black and white in the book. No, they're not allowed. If they can find something that a human said that expresses the truth, they're to use that. And that's what they did. Right, you have to take that statement seriously, and so, you know, they when they eventually get to the point where they're noting those details, they don't trip over them. Then there's no reason for someone to have their faith, you know, challenged by such a thing, and or even shattered.
Which we've seen.
But right, but it's happened gazillions of times, and that's because. Yeah, you know, everyone has been down in the weeds, and the blind are leading the blind. And it's time that more people take the light in cultivating, getting a bigger objective relationship to this. So that when someone says, well, what about, you can explain it to them. Not like, oh my gosh, I never noticed that. Oh, that's bad. I mean, if you're in that mode, you know, I mean, if a parent is no different from a child, does it work? If the parent, you know, thinks it's okay to put their hand on the burner, just like the child, is this going to go well? You know? So.
It only works if the child listens to
Yeah, anyway. Okay, so just not to beat that to death, but it's an important point to remember that the book is, if you really focus in, has lots of opportunities for error if that's what you desire. There's no truth cannot be imposed upon you.
So do you think the master physical controllers had to leave too, or just the light?
No, they're still here. Yeah.
So when they're saying life plasm, I pictured that to be the original life plasm, but they're saying future development of life plasm. I mean, do they mean
you are a blob of protoplasm? You were a blob of life plasm.
They mean genetics by that.
Right, just, I mean, this is the whole functioning system. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, they say it that way. I mean, you have matter, and then when you add life animation to it, you know, it's living matter, or if you want to remind yourself that it's not just, you know, a blob of ooze somewhere, that it's part of a body, you use the word plasm, right, instead of matter. You say it's life plasm, not merely just merely living matter. But that's technically what it is, and you know, and living matter needs, you know, is a delicate phenomenon. I mean, not, you know, the revelators don't even understand this identification of life animation to matter. So it's obviously a very subtle thing, a very delicate thing. They've discovered experientially, if nothing else, what you need to do to protect it.
It's funny that the life carriers look at us as a collective plasm. And they don't even say species.
Again, remember, they're scientists. Yeah. You know, they play with this stuff in their lab. You know, I mean, you know, remember, without being modified, you know, the first phase of life animation, you know, they can bestow it upon something just by their presence. So they can assemble something, you know, in the lab, and you know, it immediately becomes animate. And,
you know, look what the plasm did today.
it's all just
climbing the walls.
Yeah, but finally, the mere blob of ever fancier protoplasm has become a creature of will dignity. Right? See, it has dignity, right? You know, it's not merely plasm. See? That's what you're seeing, that contrast. Okay, then a final statement here.
It is just 993,408 years ago from the year AD 1934... that Urantia was formally recognized as a planet of human habitation in the universe of Nebadon. Biologic evolution had once again achieved the human levels of will dignity. Man had arrived on planet 606 of Satania. Sponsored by a life carrier of Nebadon, resident on Urantia.
There you see him stressing the Nebadon thing again, just there, you know, like they did with the Nebadon Archangel.
And they can't believe how many people have 606 in their email.
But they do note that it's yet another example of how will creatures love to imitate. Which you'll notice they mention as we get into Anna and Infanta. Yeah, but you know, you have to kind of chuckle at this, just in case you couldn't subtract 11 from the prior number, right? You know, back at the beginning of section 5, from the year AD 1934 back to the birth of the first two humans is not just 993,419 years.
You're going, it doesn't seem that long ago.
It's not. Right, it's just a million years ago, you know, it's so tangible because you basically can extrapolate now back that far, like we've talked about, and there aren't huge issues where, well, there's a radical change that happened, so your extrapolation isn't really valid, you know, like we talked about with plate tectonics and stuff. I mean, it is just so recent. But anyway, back to my point, it's like, why did they go to this, you know, even putting in from the year AD 1934, why to go to all that technical effort again just to subtract 11 from the previous number? They want to re-stress, you know, that it's a big deal. Right? When will dignity, you know, and the registration of that, you know, it was formally recognized. Right? That precise, you know, they could have given us, you know, down to the second and stuff, right? I mean, you know, it's all recorded. Right? It's an important date, right? That's why they're saying it again like that. It's not because they don't think we can't subtract 11. Oh, yeah, then remind me, formally recognized. I wanted to mention that. At the beginning of the previous paragraph, where it said that these messages from Salvington and Densha and Gerasim formally marked the termination of the life carrier's age-long supervision of the planet. The 12 Melchizedek observers don't arrive until Anna and Infanta get their adjusters. So that's when, you know, literally the new people in charge are in place. So that's why they say it that way, formally marked the termination. But technically they're still, you know, in charge until the Melchizedeks arrive. And they don't tell us exactly how long it was between you know, this point at age 11 and when they did get their adjusters. But it wasn't extremely long. All right. So we've got time to get into paper 63 here a little bit. So let's get, you know, some more about the details of our, how do they refer to them? These two little savages. All right, here we go.
Paper 63, the first human family. Urantia was registered as an inhabited world when the first two human beings, the twins, were 11 years old, and before they had become the parents of the firstborn of the second generation of actual human beings. And the archangel message from Salvington on this occasion of formal planetary recognition closed with these words: man mind has appeared on 606 of Satania And these parents of the new race shall be called Andon and Phanta. And all archangels pray that these creatures may speedily be endowed with the personal indwelling of the gift of the Spirit of the Universal Father.
Okay. Let's start at the end there first. Interesting that all archangels pray. Okay, remember they're focused on ascension, right? All archangels pray that these creatures may speedily be endowed. Okay, that they're thought adjusters. Why would they be so interested in this? You know, this happening quickly. Because you know, if they conceive children when they don't have adjusters yet, then those children won't, you know, automatically get adjusters. You know, if, you know, for us it's roughly age six, whatever the heck it was for those children. You know, so I mean, they're hoping that, you know, the adjusters come, you know, at least, you know, before any children that they have get to the point where they're in, you know, in circuit in the Holy Spirit, and right, so that they can, you know, so you've got that issue, and they'll point out that the first two will creatures on the world are very progressive, if you will. They're cut above the rest. You know, one of the main reasons is for this issue, so that they, you know, much quicker than the run-of-the-mill descendants would get an adjuster on their own, they can get adjusters so that you can get this line of spiritual descent established right up front, so that you can you can have what the archangels are very much focused on, you know, ascenders, right? You're not an ascender if you don't have an adjuster and don't have a soul. And you notice that they started out by just repeating it again about, like I said, how important this is about the acknowledgement of things, you know, that Urantia was registered as an inhabited world. And pointing out, you know, something you might have been wondering, and I'll get to the details later on. It's like, well, if they had any kids yet, right? I mean, how quickly did they have kids? Okay, so let's see. And then the other thing in there is that they shall be called Andon and Phanta, italicized there. Okay, now they obviously weren't given Latin-derived names. This is a long time before the existence of Latin. Okay. So what do they mean by that statement? Okay, they must, you know, they were given names that are the essence of the coinage of these two Latin-derived names, is what they mean by that. It's like, well, what is that coinage? Again, like I remind you, you can always, you know, pull up the etymology in the library and look some of these basic things up that I have figured out, like Andon and Phanta. And with Andon, you've got the D-O-N part of that compound construct. It's not like with Nebadon, you know, say, it's a different D-O-N. That D-O-N is like with Amadon. And D-O-N, I mean, it means in, you know, in historical usage, a distinguished man, one of position or importance, a leader and first-class man. So take those factual usages. Think about the truth, you know, the essence of that. Well, yeah, you've got, you know, you've got derivations like that, yeah. So in other words, You know, the way they're using it here, he's a true human man. Remember how they stressed that? You know, back when we were, you know, when they were first bringing that up, at one point they said the first two human beings, but then they immediately said that these two remarkable creatures were true human beings. You know, and they stressed that, you know, before that true. Right, so you think about how they talked about it. You think about, you know, sort of the basic sense. And it's like, oh, okay. So the truth of that coinage is that's a true human man. Okay, then what about the A-N part? Well, that's just, you know, in the root sense, the literal sense of that, what we use as an indefinite article. You know, it means one, you know, or first. Right. So what it means is the first true human man. And at this point, you know, if you know the sense of Adam and Eve, those Hebrew names, Adam and Eve, they've coined a parallel. That basically, Anna and Infanta have the same meaning as Adam and Eve. Oh, yeah. So biblically, we think that Adam and Eve are the first two humans. So they've played on that. They've coined two names that basically mean the same, you know, have the same essence as Adam and Eve. Adam, in this case, you know, just means human being. Okay? So they coined a parallel set. It's like, you know, the first two humans weren't Adam and Eve, but we'll coin names for them, right, that have that same spirit and are, you know, have a little more precision than kind of the fuzzy understanding of Adam and Eve in Hebrew, right? To have that first true human man for Andon. And then Fanta, you know, if you look that up in the etymology, so Fanta is one of those coinages that ends with that, you know, that basic first declension nominative Latin suffix a, you know, making a noun with that Latin suffix a. And they use that a few times. And as you reflect on it, you begin to recognize that when they use that suffix, there's an aspect of the coinage that isn't literally in the letters of the coinage. You have to fill in the blank a little bit. And so you know you have that leeway. But you take what's literally there. They play off of you from Andon. You know they're playing. They're not just using that a suffix as that sort of a general forming of a noun. I mean, you shorten an to a, right? So it again means one. So that letter can do double duty. And so again, it means the first. The, and because it's capitalized. I mean, when I capitalize it, I'm making it the something or other. The first, okay, font. Well, okay, source. Right? I mean, just, you know, the literal sense of font, right? So the first source, oh, and then I can put in parenthetically, for true human offspring. Right? Right, so you see, you know, and with Eve, you know, the basic sense is life there, the root sense. I mean, it's again, it's just in the same sense as Fanta, right? It's that source for, you know, living human beings. Source for life. See, so that's what they've done. They've just coined a pair, you know, that are basically parallel but a little bit more precise than Adam and Eve. You know, and then when you go to, you know, the statement, you know, that they shall be called. See, they shall be called, right, on the one hand, the first source for true human offspring, and the first true human man. Right? They shall be called that. Not A-N-D-O-N and F-O-N-T-A. Right? Right? They're revealing truth, not fact. Right? They're not revealing, they're not disclosing a sequence of letters. Right? So you have to, what is the truth? Right? They shall be called in truth, you know, such and so. Yep. So.
Explain all this in the next paragraph.
No, it doesn't. Okay. No, not like I'm doing it. Yeah.
Maybe I just can't read.
We'll get to what it says here in the next paragraph. Okay. That adds a little bit more to this. Okay. But just see, first of all, I mean, the italicized and in infanta, because they want you to think about the literal etymological significance. Okay, and then
that wasn't really and.
And then they're going to add to it here in this next paragraph.
Andon is the Nebidon name, which signifies the first father-like creature to exhibit human perfection hunger. Fanta signifies the first sun-like creature to exhibit human perfection hunger. Andon and Fanta never knew these names until they were bestowed upon them at the time of fusion with their thought adjusters. Throughout their mortal sojourn on Urantia, they called each other Santa Ann and Santa In. Santa Ann, meaning loved by mother. Santa In, signifying loved by father. They gave themselves these names, and the meanings are significant of their mutual regard and affection.
Okay, so let's start with the Ann and Infanta first. Okay, so it starts out, see, Andon is the Nebidon name. Okay, do they speak or derive English terms from Latin roots, on Salvington? No, again, so what they're saying is, okay, these English, with, Latin, as Latin derivative words that they've coined, they're substitutes in terms of, that give a little bit of the essence of the truth of how they're thinking about those two individuals on high, in their quote-unquote names, right? How they're being referred to, if someone points to them on high. They're saying, oh, there's the first father-like creature to exhibit human perfection hunger. And like I said, I mean, the first true human man being the literalness of it. Oh, yeah. See, so that English coinage captures some of the essence, but not all of it. See, so they're giving you this to give you a little bit more, if you were listening to them refer to them in the local universe tongue, how they would refer to them would have a little bit more dimensionality to it than what you can capture in a few letters of English coinage. Okay. But definitely that whole bit about, to exhibit human perfection hunger, they kind of captured that in the coinage. But that whole bit about father-like creature on the one hand and son-like creature on the other, see, that's a little different. Okay. Remember that what is the pattern for will creatures? Material will creatures on inhabited worlds, the material sons and daughters. And material sons and daughters are created singly by just the creator son. Okay, the creator son has two types of deity, father type and son type deity glued together. Right, father hyphen son type deity, right, and so they're reminding you that he can create in a dual fashion, and on the one hand you're going to have a father-like creature, quote unquote. On the other hand, you're going to have a son-like creature, but then, as we often remind ourselves about the fact that, he was the only one involved in making material sons and daughters, the creative mother spirit wasn't. It's like, well, where does the literal mother, aspect come from? Remember, he has that recessively, because it isn't merely the eternal son that is his parent on the Isle of Paradise. It's the eternal mother's son, right, that's his parent. And so that mother, you know, deity, if you will, is a recessive aspect, right, that can manifest. However, he's like, well, why didn't they say father-like creature and mother-like creature?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And they didn't, because you're in very short order. A mortal female is no longer functioning as a substitute, right? And is an ascending son, just like the former male. Right. And so, and see how that works so innately, that mother expression is stemming from, you know, the dominant son-like aspect of the Creator Son, right? So, yeah, that you don't want to create a being that is, you know, is mother-like in a very long-term sort of a sense, right? But just in a kind of this recessive sense for a short period of time, functions as a substitute for the Creative Mother Spirit, you know, for material, as a material womb, but then leaves that behind and manifests that dominant aspect of your, you know, effective relationship to the local universe Creator Son, and son-like. And then for the male, okay, he has a short-term bit where he's functioning in that initiator mode, you know, and then he leaves that behind too, and becomes a son, an ascending son, again, reminding you of that relationship. Yes, I mean, you know, they use the term son to remind you of the relationship to the father. But now it's, right, the father on high. He just has this little bit of a short-term functioning for the father, just like there's a short-term functioning for the mother, and then both become sons. So, yeah, see, they set it that way so that you could get into that, all that reflection, and appreciate the complexities. There are, you know, more definitive expressions of ongoing mother-like creature, right? But human females are not that, right? It's, you know, and so that's an important thing to appreciate, right? That's a, you know, that's not something you should eternalize, right? Don't think of yourself as eternally in that mode. Okay, yeah. So that's an, without just a few words, they can kind of give you all of that challenge to interpret. Okay, and then they throw in something very bizarre. And an infanta never knew these names until?
Refused.
The fact that there's an until, okay, they were, you know, until they were bestowed upon in the time of fusion with their thought adjusters. You're just left kind of puzzling over that.
This could have been many answers.
It seems that that they're, you know, as they're ascending, there was almost like this non-interference directive sort of a thing going on. See, I mean, that they needed to be kind of just in that natural and not have that really up front that, oh, you're the special ones, remember, and, you know, and that must be what's going on, but it's kind of an odd thing.
Let's not shackle them with the stigma, right?
you know, because they would have probably, right, just awakened, you know, it's some millennial resurrection, you know. I mean, you know, maybe you could assume there was a special one for them and a few others, but I don't know. I mean, you know, they didn't get the third circle or anything, right, in their short little life. So, I mean, there would have been a group resurrection, small or large, of some fashion. So, you know, they would just been one of the bunch. You know, and it appears that they may have been kind of trying to keep them that way until later on. It's like, oh, by the way. So you wonder, it's like, well, couldn't they have looked up that fact in the records? That's why I said it's kind of mysterious. I don't know quite how to resolve all that. Yeah.
Which has some meaning.
Yeah.
They're on the 24, right?
No. But remember, they do have that special greeter role and stuff, yeah. Okay, and then kind of the fun stuff. Giving us a little bit of Andonite tongue here. So you see this Santa, you know, is the loved by part. And then it's, you know, on or... And just simple, you know, not surprising that there would be just simple little, you know, words. You know, think about how when you first start, most of your words are like three letters, you know, a consonant, a vowel, and a consonant, you know, like cat and dog, and right? It starts out very, very simple, so you can see that.
Which one do you think was called which?
Well, okay, so now that, yeah, that's what I was going to get to. So, you know, how to properly interpret this? The clue about how to properly interpret it is at the end. See, they gave themselves these names, and the meanings are significant of their mutual regard and affection. Okay, so the mother and father there is not their primates' parents. No, it's, I'm Fanta. I'm mother. Right? And, I love you. And you're loved by mother. And vice versa. Fanta, right? I'm Andon. I'm father. And I love you. You are loved by father. You know, think about how, you know, a lot of times parents, you know, refer to, you know, themselves mother and father like that, you know, in the context of the family.
So Santa An was Anda.
Yeah, I mean, see, they're keeping them in order. You know, okay. It's Andon and Fanta, so it's Santa, you know, An or in Santa N. Yeah, yeah. You know, Andon is loved by Fanta, and Fanta is loved by Andon. The mutual regard and affection. They just refer to each other in that mutual mode, which is pretty cool. You know, see, it's very symmetric and you know, mutual, like they said, and reciprocal and coordinate. Right? They immediately saw themselves as a coordinate pair. Right? That together they were whole. You know, and just the language, you know, has that they have something innately in common in their names, Santa, right? Right? And then there's two different phases of the one whole. There's the on phase and the end phase. See? So it's really kind of cool. See how they're already using the language in a sort of instinctually in a reflective mode like that. two different expressions of a same, you know, holistic truth. Okay, so yep. Here, we have just enough time to read this little short section here, too.
Number one, Andon and Fanta. In many respects, Andon and Fanta were the most remarkable pair of human beings that have ever lived on the face of the earth. This wonderful pair, the actual parents of all mankind, were in every way superior to many of their immediate descendants. And they were radically different from all of their ancestors, both immediate and remote.
See, there's where you know, reflect on that statement. That's what I keep. That's the facts in the book that I keep alluding to when I talk about how they, you know, these first two are cut above. I mean that's a strong statement. In many respects, they were the most remarkable pair of human beings that have ever lived on the face of the earth.
That makes me think that they maybe did ascend in 3 days.
Well, the thing that is most immediate about that is not what we're always interested in, how quickly we're going to be resurrected in heaven, okay? The thing that's most important about that is how quickly they get their adjusters, okay? I mean, how quickly they meet those prerequisites, right? They don't have parents with adjusters, okay? They've got to get them on their own, right? And they're not going to get the third circler, right? So they're not going to get it in that sort of mode. It's going to be one of those, you know, kind of more special modes. But, you know, they're going to get it in very short order. I mean, they're just 11, right? Okay? And they're going to have kids quickly here. They've got to have enough of an innate nature for an adjuster to be able to make contact. You know, you can't just send an adjuster because you want to, because I really want them to have, so I'm just going to give them an adjuster. They don't deserve it. No, there's a technical issue. I mean, they have to somehow, the adjuster can only do half of the linkage. It can come halfway down, and the human has to come the other halfway up, and the two meet in the middle. Right? And if you don't come the rest of the way up, I mean, there is no connection.
There's no spirit of truth here.
So. There's no spirit of truth to catalyze this, to speed it up or anything like that. Right? Yeah.
Culture.
Right. I mean, there's no culture. There's no nothing. Right. Okay. Right. See, that's what they're saying. In many respects, they were the most remarkable pair. Right. Very precocious. As they said, little savages. Savages, yes, but in other ways, no. Right? In terms of this internal dynamics, very advanced. Getting adjuster on their own, bootstrapping themselves, right, in very short order. Quite remarkable, as they say there. And again, the fact that it isn't, boom, you go to this incredible thing and then it stays up there. I mean, you know, they point out, no, they really are a cut above, because they have to sort of establish the connection to the cosmos for all their descendants. And things can drop back down to kind of more what you'd expect after them, but they have to be a cut above. There has to be a bit of the end from the beginning embodied in them, and see coincidentally, right, as they said there at the end of the previous paper, biologic evolution had once again achieved, right, in the wholeness of God the Mother, right, the God of evolution. Coincidentally, these two individuals are cut above and. Everything comes together. It's all a system. It all has the purpose inherent in it. They are what they need to be, you know, and their descendants didn't need to be that, and so they weren't. Okay, keep going here.
The parents of this first human couple were apparently little different from the average of their tribe, though they were among its more intelligent members. That group, which first learned to throw stones and to use clubs in fighting, they also made use of sharp spicules of stone, flint, and bone.
In other words, you know, little spikes or little points, spicules. Just quickly, I mean, you know, reminding you of with the primates, just to how advanced the uses of the fourth adjutant. You know, was getting. You know, you have some pretty sophisticated relationship to tools, you know, already happening, you know, and they're not human. They're just fancy animals. Okay.
While still living with his parents, Andon had fastened a sharp piece of flint on the end of a club, using animal tendons for this purpose. And on no less than a dozen occasions, he made good use of such a weapon in saving both his own life and that of his equally adventurous and inquisitive sister, who unfailingly accompanied him on all of his tours of exploration.
Just delightful to think of the two scampering off and getting into mischief. But she noticed, she goes, oh, I see why they gave me that little bit in the previous paragraph. Okay, it's one thing to just have enough of a sense, with the fourth adjutant to do some crude use of pre-existent tool potential objects, right? But to step back and reflect on it, it's like, well, I have this object and this object, ooh, and that, and I could put that together. I could take, you could take the club and the spicule of flint, right? And the animal tendons. Oh, I could put those three together and I could make a composite, fancier tool. See, that requires encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That requires some logical acumen, right? And some ability to step back and reflect on it. Right? See the big picture, right? And put things together in that big picture. Yeah, so that's they're just pointing out the contrast. What you look for archaeologically, right, is the difference between just fancy animal stuff and human stuff.
It's really creative.
Right, see, it's creative, yeah. See. It's not just taking advantage of an opportunity that you stumble upon, right, and have enough, mm-hmm. Mentality to notice. Yeah.
Being carnivorous was handy because they had these leftover bits that...
Yeah, right, they had animal tendons, like, so, yeah. Yeah, remember how much they stressed that they were meat eaters, right? Yeah.
The decision of Andon and Fauna to flee from the primates' tribes implies a quality of mind far above the baser intelligence which characterized so many of their later descendants who stooped to mate with their retarded cousins of the simian tribes. But their vague feeling of being something more than mere animals was due to the possession of personality and was augmented by the indwelling presence of the thought adjusters.
See, it kind of indicates that the thought adjusters came in relatively short order. But see, again, you notice what they're wanting you to just reflect on a little bit. See, they have some rudimentary reflective thinking going on. They're stepping back, and considering the big picture, discriminating between greater and lesser. And they recognize the difference, and they have some foresight, so they can project that forward a little bit. It's like, okay, yeah, that wouldn't go well. No, I'm not going to do that. Right? They can learn by looking, not just by leaping. And see, they're just trying to get you to notice that those things in a rudimentary fashion are in play. It's very rudimentary, they're very, but they're vague feeling, right? Right, it's going to be very vague, and especially for these will creatures because they're pre-sangic, as I've pointed out. They're a cut above many, in some ways, and in other ways, they're quite limited, as they'll talk about as we, continue on next time. But, yep, you got...
Yeah, so we started the class talking about the personality part, and they just brought it up here again.
Yep.
Do you think the personality preceded this, or was it caused by? In other words, you said that... Which one came first?
So I ran through that quickly a little bit ago, but I'll say it again. So... You've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 adjutant,
right?
Okay, and the instant that the seventh adjutant engages an individual, there's an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, no delay. And the instant that there's an encirclement in the Holy Spirit, the personality identifies with that mind or self.
Okay, I got that part. But you also said the personality has been, it's basically infinite. It's been,
okay,
been there all along.
Right, a personality.
How does it know that you're going to get encircled?
Right, so again, a personality is not an object. Okay. And we talk about it like it was an object, but remember it's not.
We all have one.
Right, but what we have is an influence from eternity. Okay. There's an influence from eternity, not from time, but an influence from eternity that identifies with a mindful self in time.
And makes it unique?
Well, and that pattern, that influence from eternity is a spirit pattern. That's an absolutely unique pattern. So it's an absolutely unique influence from eternity. There's an influence imposed upon that mindful self that's absolutely unique. And it's from eternity, engaging time. Again, see, it's a mystery of mysteries, right? About how there's this relationship between eternity and time. That's a mystery of mysteries. But it's there. You can observe the fact that you have an individual who is standing above the temporal sequence, and, you know, in their mind, and altering it.
It's a gift from the Father,
it's a right. That's a gift from the Father, right? That you think of that influence from eternity coming from the Father. Where is the Father? The Father's in eternity, right? And so, I mean, get specifically where, you know, or from what in eternity? Well, yes, from the Father. But just appreciate it. It's your potential to start with eternity and then go to time. Right? To strike step top down, right? It's this potential that you can actualize. It's like, you know, I could potentially orient myself top down and approach my temporal life from above that temporality. Let's do that. Let's actualize some of my personality. You know, instead of letting my mind do its normal temporal sequence that's natural, right, that what causality of mind energy and the material boundary conditions dictate for the sequence of events of that mindful self, let me approach it from the top down, take a hold of its reins, and say, no, you're not going to respond naturally to that negative environmental stimulus, that is, negatively. You're going to respond positively to that negative environmental stimulus. And why? Because that puts you in relationship to eternity, right? Instead of just a time. The natural response has no relationship to eternity. The creative, the artificial, the unnatural response, right? What's the motivation behind? Why are you responding positively to a negative stimulus? Because that's what something that is real, that has the constancy and quality of eternity, that's what it does.
But even positively is reflective.
But see,
sometimes when Jesus was berating his apostles, it may not have seemed positively. But, I mean, so it's hard, you know,
right,
you're growing all that.
But, you know, I'm just, you know, that simple contrast, positive, negative, just as you, you know, what you're doing, you know, you also, you know, want to, you don't want to just naturally respond positively to a positive stimulus.
Right.
You want to do that creatively as well, and eventually absolutely uniquely, right? You want to respond positively to a positive stimulus only as you can potentially do.
That's why I say personality is creative.
Creativity is only there with personality. And what creativity is not mind over matter.
It's not the little kid putting two blocks together on the floor.
Right. It's recognizing that something preceded that, perhaps. Right. The creativity is spirit over mind. Using your personality to take a hold of spirit and wield the mind from above. spirit dominates mind.
I was just thinking wield, and you said it.
Yeah. That's, you know, see, humans have never understood this because they've never had more than two elements in their philosophy, body and mind. So no one's ever understood what creativity actually refers to, what free will refers to. It's only with the fifth epical revelation that you can finally figure out what those are about. Free will is not about what you can do mind over matter. That's just self-assertion. Free will is about using your personality, spirit grabber, that spirit pattern, to take a hold of spirit from above mind and wield the mind, you know, and creatively establish forms in the mind that are unnatural. You know, and in like in paper 101 in the religion papers, right, they give you 12 bullet points of 12 negative environmental stimuli and a positive response to that negative stimulus. And then they say, if you don't function like that, you are not a religionist. Because that's what a religionist is someone that's human, it's personal. Right? Yeah, religious consciousness is about personal spiritual experience, not merely spiritual experience. Spiritual experience is natural. Religious experience, personal spiritual experience, as they say right after that list of 12, is unnatural. It's creative. It's artificial. It's an art form.
Doing it God's way.
Until you create, well, just doing it any way that's unnatural, using your personality. You're not technically a religionist. You're not bound back to eternity, what the word religion refers to. The RE is back to eternity, right? Until you're doing that, until you've gotten above the temporal phenomenon, right, and have begun to take control of that self, heading towards self-mastery. Again, like I told you, you can coin a word for what people technically are, you know, when we say they're a religionist, but they're a so-called religionist. They're technically an oligenist. They're not bound back to eternity. They're bound to time. They're bound to, not back. Right? And they've just declared that if you bind yourself to time in this particular doctrinal way, you're a religionist. You know, if you bind yourself to time in this fancy way instead of the typical way, that makes you a religionist. No, that doesn't. Right? Because, right, someone who's bound to time like that is a helpless victim of antecedent causation. Right? They respond positively to a positive stimulus. They feel joy. Or they respond negatively to a negative stimulus. They feel sorrow. A religionist is in control. Right? You choose to respond positively to a negative stimulus.
That's what the Beatitudes were all about. Taking a bunch of negative stimulus and saying, you're happy here.
Right. Not joyful. Right. That's natural. Happy is unnatural. Right? Like I've stressed so many times, right? That's a religionist. Only a religionist can be happy. Merely someone with spiritual experience, all they can do is be joyful. And that's dependent upon the environment. Right? You're a helpless victim of antecedent causation in the environment. If there's a positive spiritual environment, okay, you're joyful. Okay, big deal, right? That's just a fancy blob of protoplasm. Right? You're not human.
But I think there's joy that comes from more than the environment.
Well,
a higher level of it.
But see, that what the revelators are trying to say, that higher word is the word happy, is happiness. We, you know, the fact that we've made it lesser than joy is not, you know, that's our problem.
They
about
right, we know almost nothing of happiness. See, because there's almost no religionist. There's, all right. All right. Religion yields happiness. You know nothing about almost nothing about happiness. Ah, in other words, there's almost no religionists. Yes. Right. There's lots of so-called religionists, but not genuine religionists. Not those who are in control of themselves. They've just found fancy ways to be stimulated, you know, and live on the affectations of that.
You're not going to be busy praying for your environment to be better.
No.
If you're already happy.
No. And if you're praying, you're praying for a challenging environment so you have yet another opportunity to respond positively to a negative stimulus. That's courageous in independent cosmic thinking. Right? Not the craven beings that we call religionists who are dominated by fear and seeking some escape from negative stimuli. Right? Yeah, their religion is escapism. Okay, well, we went way over there anyway.
Happy your day.
But it's always important to come back to some of those main themes. I mean, that's what the fifth epical revelation is about. All right, you know, and we'll get into that, you know, that fear-based religion here as we read about the Andonites. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.